Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Don. I'm Dr. Don Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, healthcare, and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your emails and your calls. It's all here on Ask Dr. Don, so I hope you'll stay tuned. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So, I had some really interesting stuff to tell you about, and I was trying to decide which one would be the feel-good topic of the day, because, you know, we need a feel-good topic today. I felt a little thwarted getting here this morning. But amongst all of the interesting stories I had, the feel-good topic of the day is about walnuts and diabetes. This is a study that looks at what we call a functional response. And you've heard me talk about functional medicine. You know, functional is one of those weird words. Sometimes it means it's all in your head. Sometimes it means that it's how the body works. And when we use the term functional medicine, that's really what we're talking about. It's looking at how the body works, not just the sort of dissected on the table dead body, but the actual living, walking around, breathing body. And so a functional test for heart disease, for example, would be endothelial function, whereas chop open the dead heart and look at how much plaque there was and score heart disease that way. Well, that's great, except you're dead, so it isn't really going to help you. A better test would be to figure out that you have heart disease in the earliest possible stages when it was at its most reversible. And endothelial function is exactly that. The endothelial cells are the cells inside your blood vessels. They are exposed to everything that's in your bloodstream, and we can measure their functioning by a test called flow-mediated dilatation. So flow-mediated dilatation is where you compress the blood vessel with a blood pressure cuff, and then that starves the tissue at a distance of oxygen. Then when you open up the cuff, you see how much the blood vessels open up to reperfuse that area. In a healthy blood vessel, that'll happen really rapidly. In an unhealthy blood vessel, let's say one belonging to a poorly controlled diabetic with high cholesterol, that happens more slowly. And indeed, even in well-controlled diabetics, we do see differences in endothelial function. And this is also one of the things that contributes to high blood pressure. And one of the earliest signs of endothelial function is actually loss of the strength and power of your erections, guys. So if you're starting to see a little deficit in that department, that's probably an endothelial function. That's how Viagra works, by raising nitric oxide in the blood vessels. That opens up the blood vessels. But the endothelial cells are supposed to do that on their own. Well, now to the feel-good part. In this subject, 24 subjects in the study were involved in a crossover trial, and they measured endothelial function. The subjects were all diabetic, and they were given just a quote-unquote diabetic diet and asked to follow it, and then half of them were given 56 grams, that's about 2 ounces of walnuts a day. And they were asked, eat the walnuts every day. That's it. Now, interestingly enough, both groups actually had improvements in their hemoglobin A1C and their cholesterol because they were being watched. But the cholesterol actually dropped significantly more in the group eating walnuts. The group eating walnuts did not gain weight, which, given that they were consuming about 350 calories worth of walnuts every day, is interesting in and of itself. But the real slam dunk on this study was that there was a very highly significant improvement in endothelial function after only 8 weeks eating the walnuts every day. So I've been encouraging my diabetics and my patients with hypertension to consume nuts on a regular basis. I've already known about the almonds, and I know we've talked about how good almonds are in improving diabetic control, but did you know that walnuts work well for endothelial function? I certainly didn't until I read this study. What in the long run does it mean? Well, it means eat food, mostly plants, and not too much. So interesting, since we're on a diabetic roll with that first story, with the walnuts, let's talk a little bit about some more things that have come down around diabetes and inflammation. A big story about the use of Avandia, big controversy there. That's a drug that's used to improve the insulin receptor sensitivity, so it only works in type 2 diabetes. And there are two drugs, Avandia or rosiglitazone, and Actos or pioglitazone. And these two drugs have become one of the mainstays for diabetic management. For me, the way I usually approach diabetes is, first of all, really getting in the person's face and telling them they've eaten their last Pop-Tart. No more white flour, no more white sugar, as little as possible. You've eaten your lifetime quota. That usually gets a laugh and then an, oh my God, what am I going to do without my donut thought. And some people actually grieve the loss of all of their favorite foods. Well, yeah, that's true. But you've got a disease that is interfering with your ability to process these foods, and these are no longer sources of nourishment for you. They're sources of danger. So you really have to reframe. That being said, the next step after diet and the use of judicious nutritional products, which would include things like cinnamon, alpha-lipoic acid, and chromium, is exercise. Now, once you've incorporated all of these things, it's amazing how many people, if they actually just exercise and change their diet, do not require drugs. But there's a number of people who do, and those who do require drugs, I usually suggest the use of metformin and either insulin or Actos. Now, years ago, I just guessed right when it came to, am I going to go with Actos or am I going to go with Avandia? And to be honest with you, I may have been influenced as much as anything by the amount of free samples on the shelves in my office in terms of that preference. Or it may have been that I thought that the Actos advertising puppets were cute. I really don't know what causes me to make subconscious decisions like that, but I suspect there may have been some drug company promotional factors involved. Maybe they gave out better pens. Who knows? I guessed right, or at least when the stories about Avandia came out in 2007, most of my patients were on the opposite drug and I didn't need to switch too many of them. At that time, we thought that probably the difference is due to increased fluid retention with the Avandia, leading to more difficulties for the heart failure, more stress on the heart. And indeed, the recent studies that were just published bear that out. If you do the analysis, it looks like there's about a 30% increase in cardiac-related events when you're on Avandia compared to when you're on Actos. And that's enough, given that a cardiovascular disease is what kills three-quarters of diabetics. That's enough to make us want to rethink Avandia. And if you're using this drug, you may want to rethink using it. The FDA has got a little black box warning on there, and there's talk now of pulling it, but who knows whether that will actually happen. Let's say there's a lot of special interest involved in these decisions that is outside of the science, and maybe way too many special interests outside of the science. Could germs be making you fat? A recent study looking at mice suggests that the type of gut flora you have may be extremely significant in terms of obesity. These researchers suggest that obesity may at least partially be hereditary because people in families tend to be contaminated, or rather I should say colonized, with the same bacteria. In the mouse study, mice were given bacteria from obese mice, and these mice developed obesity. The other thing that happened was that when they took the same mice who had the same exposures and removed those bacteria through a sterilization process and replaced them with bacteria from healthy thin mice, those mice lost the weight and became normal in size. We've thought that perhaps use of probiotics could be helpful in weight loss. There have been some preliminary scientific studies in humans that even bear that out. But it's so much easier to study mice than humans because, after all, you can control what a mouse eats and what they're exposed to. And you sure can't do that with humans. Anyway, maybe somewhere off in the future, along with special probiotic yogurt to treat constipation. We'll be looking at probiotics that are scientifically designed to help us with weight loss. And you know what? That's not such a bad thing. I'd love to see that happen. I'd like to see us use more natural materials and less new-to-nature molecules, since you never really know what's going to happen on the other end with those. Let's take a few moments and review the week in healthcare. Let's start with just looking at the Obama healthcare proposal and what it discusses. It will create by 2014, which, you know, folks, that's 4 years. That's not too long from now. State-based marketplaces where small businesses and individuals could obtain coverage. These would be people unable to obtain coverage at work and ineligible for public program, the so-called private market, which in the last year has seen their costs go up as much as 40% per annum. That's a huge jump. It would also have an individual mandate, meaning that you have to play. You have to have health insurance. And if you don't, you pay a penalty. There are exemptions for certain poverty cases, and that's definitely the devil in the details right there, because who do you exempt? And if you exempt enough people, you've sort of defeated the purpose of the mandate. It does provide tax credits for the individuals. I won't go into the specifics too deeply, but if you're a family of four making $88,000, then you wouldn't qualify for a subsidy. If you make below that, you would. It would expand Medicaid, which is nice, letting it go up to 133% of the poverty level. The Medicare drug benefit with the donut hole, that would go away. Employers and companies with more than 50 workers would pay a penalty if they did not offer coverage. And if you had under 25 workers, you could get a subsidy or a tax credit from the government for providing health insurance. Then we come down to the, how shall I put this, the deal breakers, the things that allow people to get up on their political soapboxes and yell and scream and get votes next year. And that's really what it's all about, isn't it? And that would be illegal immigrants and abortion. So illegal immigrants could not buy insurance in the exchanges. And abortion, it's nuts. They have some sort of crazy thing where if you get a federal subsidy, you could choose a plan that has an abortion, but you're actually going to have to make two different payments, one into the abortion pot and one into the regular plan pot. Oh, God. Anyway, new taxes. Yep, there will be new taxes to finance this starting in 2018. And there's a tax on very expensive health plans, $10,000 for individual coverage, $27,000 for family. And there's an increase on the Medicare payroll tax for couples earning over $250,000 a year. Okay, now, way down at the bottom, we have two insurance regulations. They actually do make the insurance companies do something, which is that you have to cover adult dependents up to the age of 26. That means your kids who are in college can get coverage through your health plan. And you can't set annual and lifetime limits for outlay or deny coverage because of pre-existing conditions. Well, gee, I'm so thrilled with this extremely watered down healthcare plan, something that we had really hoped we would see much better. And the elephant in the room is still the elephant in the room. Just to remind you, in this country, at least 20% of every premium dollar goes to non-medical costs, paperwork, profits, overhead. On my part, it's all overhead. On the insurance company part, it feels like it's all profit. In France and Germany, it's 5%, and they have private insurance companies. The reason it's 5% is because we don't have 6,000 different rules, six different kinds of charges and coding systems, all kinds of gimmicks to shift cost, lots of paperwork, and lots of people whose job is just to navigate these complicated systems. You know what? That adds up to cost savings, and it doesn't hurt anybody. The other thing they've got in France and Germany is they've got a centralized database, which means if you had an MRI last year in Wisconsin, I can look it up. In fact, most of the time, like in France, you've got the results of the MRI on your little smart card that you walk in with on your key fob. I can look up your MRI. I really don't need to order another one. I really don't need to wait 2 weeks until the report from the one in Wisconsin comes back. why don't we have this? We've got the Silicon Valley. We've got all of this wonderful technology. And, you know, back in 1993, there was this guy named Bill Clinton who held up a smart card and said, everyone will have this. Okay, we need this. This is ridiculous. We have to get moving on this. And I'm afraid, as Marcia Angel said last night on Bill Moyer's Journal, that by passing this legislation, we may actually stop progress because it's going to be too little, too late, not enough, and an inordinate amount of effort to get nowhere or almost nowhere. Let's take one call. Stephanie in Salinas, what can I do for you, love?
Well, I'm sorry to take you so far off the subject.
Not a problem.
I have a question about my plantar fasciitis.
Okay.
Which I've self-diagnosed on WebMD. And my question is whether I can continue to exercise or if I should take it easy for a while if I do the proper stretching.
What kind of exercise do you like to do?
I like to do aerobic exercise, like aerobic dance.
Okay. First of all, anything that bounces on the bottom of your feet is a bad idea right now.
Uh-huh.
So the exercise like aerobics and anything that's kind of impacty on the heel, not a good idea. Maybe you could switch to bicycling.
Bicycling, okay.
That would be an alternative. Swimming would be an alternative. You can find a heated pool this time of year. Those are two good strategies that don't put pressure on the plantar fascia. Weightlifting, you know, resistance work with rubber bands, yoga, but bouncy high impact things at the moment while you're trying to treat this, not a good idea. Now, stretches, very, very important because most plantar fasciitis is caused, I think at least, by a combination of two factors, tight heel cords and a tight Achilles tendon and things that strengthen those muscles and a loss of shock absorber power in the heel. Now, as we get older, the bubble wrap that our feet are wrapped in does what bubble wrap does. It breaks down. And so we no longer have the shock absorption that we had when we were children and could, you know, bounce around on cement barefoot without it bothering us. That combined with the tightening of the heel cord puts the connection point on the base of the heel where all of the tendons of the feet and the tendons from the back of the leg combine. You know, that's the fulcrum point where we go toes down, toes up. But when that area becomes irritated, it's almost like a stress fracture. It isn't a true stress fracture, but it behaves like one. So, for example, in the morning, you have pain on the bottom of your foot that's really bad when you first stand up. And then when you get standing up and start moving around, eventually you walk it out and you're good until you rest. And then it comes back. Some people sleep with a brace that keeps their ankles at 90 degrees. That can be very helpful in plantar fasciitis, and I've had a lot of people tell me that worked for them. I really recommend extra padding on the heel and arch support. You get a couple of those over-the-counter heel pads that have a circle in the center of the heel and wear those. I usually tell people to double up if they're buying the really cheap ones, but expensive ones running, you know, $18 to $20. You can also just take an X-Acto knife and cut a hole in the direct center of a heel and then wear that with an arch support. It's particularly important to look at the exercise shoes you're wearing. Make sure that they're very, very well padded. Do the stretching. And as this improves, you need to go back to your aerobics gently, not aggressively. Recent study came out looking at carotid artery disease. We were talking earlier about endothelial dysfunction as an early sign, a functional sign of poor health or incipient atherosclerosis. Well, in the end stage of atherosclerosis, you develop plaque or narrowing in your arteries. And one of the most critical arteries is the one going to your brain, your carotid artery. Now, it's long been controversial about whether or not we should be going in and surgically removing plaque or doing what's done in hearts with stents and angioplasty. So the results are out on the CREST trial. This was a big trial, more than 2,500 patients in the United States and Canada. This study was trying to ask the question, is it better to do an endarterectomy or is it better to do a stent? And the research basically showed that they're about equivalent. endarterectomy and removal of the plaque has a slightly higher risk. They have different adverse events. The difference between a stroke and a heart attack is essentially the case. So when you do the endarterectomy, there's a slightly higher risk of having heart attack while you're having surgery, and that makes sense. It's general anesthesia, after all. When they do the angioplasty with the stent, they don't need to put you under because it's not a particularly painful procedure, and they're not cutting anywhere. So as a result, they don't put you to sleep, you don't have the cardiac complications, but they are messing around in the carotid artery, and so the chances of little bits of plaque or little blood clots breaking off while they're doing that is a little bit higher. So you see a increase in the post-stroke risk. This isn't something that should be done on everybody. It should be done only on people who are significantly at risk for having a stroke. And these are people with a stenosis of greater than 70% who've already suffered a issue around their brain, such as a transient ischemic attack. Let's go to an email. This one from Laura in Monterey. Laura says, "Dear Dr. Don, love your show. I'm a 46-year-old woman who has had regular periods up until 2 months ago. I'm experiencing some stress due to a recent separation from my partner of 13 years. I've had hot flashes and night sweats occasionally over the last year or so, but the frequency and intensity has really picked up over the last month. I exercise 3 to 6 times per week, and I eat healthy. Are there certain foods or other things I could do to mitigate the power surges I'm experiencing?" Well, I like your framing of it as a power surge, Laura, and do have a couple suggestions for you. First of all, some sort of stress reduction is really important right now, and that could be meditation, it could be Tai Chi or yoga if you have those skills, but something to lower your adrenaline, because when you are going through the transition, the combination of adrenaline plus estrogen withdrawal is just a recipe for hot flashes. So you need to do calming type exercises. Green tea has actually been shown in some studies to be really useful, especially if you are eliminating coffee and substituting green tea. And a good trick for reducing the caffeine even further in green tea is to throw either your tea bag or your loose leaves in hot water for 30 seconds and then strain off the water and re-add new hot water. Most of the caffeine will have leached out of those leaves in the first 30 seconds. So that's a good trick. Reducing chocolate, reducing other caffeinated beverages such as colas, very useful. Reducing alcohol, very useful. So after you've taken those steps, if you're still having problems, increasing the amount of soy isoflavones in your diet, you could do that by getting soy protein powder and making a smoothie. And then we get into the herbs that are often used for easing the transition. Since you only stopped your periods 2 months ago, the herb called chasteberry or vitex might work really well for you. So I want to recommend you give that one a try. Another email, this one from Rhea in Ben Lomond. "In this country, after age 65, which should I choose, HMO option or PPO option? PPO used to seem like the Cadillac insurance, but now I see several doctors want Health Net. Isn't that an HMO?" Yeah, it's confusing, isn't it, Rhea? Basically, in this community, because we are considered rural, we receive 20% less than urban areas from Medicare, which is pretty much the profit margin. So most doctors who are doing Medicare patients in Santa Cruz County are doing it at break even or even losing some money on some of their patients. Now, that doesn't sound like a good business policy for the long-term survivability of your medical practice, but that's the current situation. Now, the HMO option works better for the doctors in this local area because the doctors receive a retainer, and it works out that they make more money per patient, all things considered, with patients for whom they receive that retainer monthly payment than they do from Medicare. So in general, doctors prefer the HMO option locally for that reason. It's a little bit better for them financially. With respect to PPOs, that is not the case. There is a generally not as good a financial incentive after you change to 65, after you change to Medicare. Before, the incentives tend to be more variable, and it depends on the health of your practice. I had one of my doctor partners, I said, so what kind of patients are you looking for? And he said, 28-year-old Asian HMO patients, males only, because they never come to the doctor and they never complain. So I'll get paid every month to see them, but I'll never have to spend any time or energy on them. Well, I don't think you can construct a medical practice that way, but it was a good joke, and it does describe the absurdity of the current economic situation fairly well. So I guess if my advice to Rhea would be, if you want to have a selection of doctors to choose from, you're better off going with the Medicare HMO in Santa Cruz County. Let's talk to Gene in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gene. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
And yes, you have helped me over the years, and so I must make a pledge. Anyway, in fact, 11 years ago, I was diagnosed with stenosis, I guess you call it, stenosis of the spine.
Uh-huh.
And I met a surgeon who wanted to cut me, and I talked to you, and you said, no, no, go get a second opinion. Second opinion, say go get physical therapy. And yes, that worked. And that's 11 years ago. I've had some relapses of that occasionally. Go get my regular doctor, send me the physical therapist, and I'm well. Last year, though, my arm started hurting, only it wasn't like, you know, the stenosis that gets you the tingling and stuff. It was actually a little intermittent pain up around the upper arm. So finally, it hurt a lot. So I saw the doctor. I got a referral to my physical therapist. My doctor did the test. I guess you hold out your arm and push down on it. And he said I had some weakness in there. My physical therapist did the same thing, but he also probed a few places. And I went, ow, ow, ow. And he says, you have tendonitis of the rotator cuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started his treatment. My question is, it's been pretty successful too. You know, it's taken a while, but I haven't seen him recently. And when do I know I'm well? With the other, with the stenosis, he did his little thing. You know, I'm fine, no pain or anything. This, I go to bed and I get up in the morning, I still have some residual pain and wherever that is, the upper arm around my bicep or shoulder or whatever. But it goes away during the day. Is that to be expected for my foreseeable future, or should I keep seeing him and he can make that go away too?
Door number two. You should be able to completely get it back to dormancy, but that doesn't mean you don't have a vulnerability where you can potentially flare this up. How old are you?
65.
All right, so you're 65. You're going to have some things that are a little bit creaky, some things that are a little bit tight, some things that are a little too loose.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, exactly. So the shoulder tends to tighten up as we age. And one of the reasons for this is our posture and our behavior in our culture is very forward. We drive, we sit at computer keyboards, we read, we watch television, we slouch. We don't reach up over our head that much. We don't hang from our arms. And the upper shoulder girdle muscles in the back between the shoulder blades, as we age, naturally tend to get looser and weaker, and the pectoralis muscles in the front of our chest tend to get tighter. This causes the upper arm bone to roll inward, and doing so, it brings this protuberance called the greater tuberosity into line with the bottom part of the clavicle and a protrusion off the shoulder blade called the acromion. Now, that's the roof of your shoulder joint. And naturally, if you're rubbing a big bony protuberance right under the roof, anything between those two is getting squeezed. And guess what the result is? Tendonitis.
Yeah, he talked about when it was really started, it would be painful even. He said it was breaking up scar tissue. Scar tissue from what? I didn't do anything.
Adhesions. The scar tissue forms as a result of inflammation. See, inflammation is like a little slow burn fire, and it creates oxidative stress, and you get tissue damage, and you get the fibroblasts actually proliferate, and that's where the scar tissue comes from.
Oh.
So it is a common side effect of chronic low-grade inflammation is that you get scar tissue forming, particularly in the shoulder, because it is microtrauma. So keep doing your exercises. Be sure that you build up the rhomboid and the teres muscles, and you can go look on the back, the map, the muscles to figure out where those are. But rowing is a really good exercise for that. Low rowing, where you keep your your hands and wrist below the level of your nipples. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the elbows down rowing.
Yeah, I have a band where I do a sort of exercise like that too,
perfect.
I guess.
Yeah, that is so helpful long term for getting the shoulder under control. And then you need to look at, you know, when you do something sports-wise or you paint the ceiling in the bathroom and you flare it, you get right on it with ice. And you notice I said when you flare it, not if you flare it?
Yeah.
Okay. And
got it.
Yeah. So when you flare it, you get on there with ice, you get on there with some anti-inflammatories, you keep stretching and moving it because you don't want more scar tissue to form, and you manage it.
Also, at this point, heat seems to have helped.
Yes. But when you first injure it, when like I said,
if I have a flare-up,
when you have a flare-up, you ice maybe the first 48 hours. That helps keep the inflammation down. And I'm not a great fan of long-term daily non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, but at moments like that the good Lord invented Motrin for. So that's when you get out the ibuprofen and you slam some ibuprofen. Oh, I've hurt myself. Let me take some ibuprofen now to reduce the amount of inflammation I'm going to get from this.
Fantastic.
Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let me tell you about a food recall. We've been talking about the kind of help you get, especially from this program. Here's a little bit of a utility that I hope you'll take advantage of, and that's the AskDrDawn.com website. We've just posted a list on this food recall that the FDA has instituted, and this is a compound called HVP, which stands for hydrolyzed vegetable protein. It's a food flavoring. It's used in a lot of processed foods. And this is soups, sauces, chilies, stews, hot dogs, gravy, seasoned snack foods, dressing. You've probably got some of this stuff in your kitchen. So we've posted a link on AskDrDawn.com to the list of foods that was released by the FDA. These foods are being recalled because the product, this HVP, was found to contain salmonella. Now, fortunately, a lot of the foods that we're talking about do go through something called a kill cycle where they basically steam or heat things to a level that should kill the bacteria, should, in quotes there. But nevertheless, all of these foods are being pulled, and it's very important, particularly if you have elders or children in the house, that you look at these foods and make sure you don't eat any of them. So please go to our website or to the foodsafety.gov website and check those things out. This related issue, this is from the Produce Safety Project at Georgetown University, and they're looking at foodborne illness. And what they suggest is that the cost nationally of foodborne illnesses is $152 billion a year. That's four times more than the calculations of the Department of Agriculture. What they're suggesting is that many, many pathogens, norovirus, salmonella, make more than 1 million Americans sick every year, and we don't identify these illnesses as foodborne illnesses. We just call it stomach flu. Now, I bet that any of the people listening out there in the last 2 years have actually had a foodborne illness and they thought they had stomach flu. So I'll tell you the difference. When you get a foodborne illness, you generally become sick very rapidly, usually with both nausea and diarrhea, and you feel just dreadful really quickly. But the next day, you're much better. And 2 days out, aside from being maybe a little weak or maybe a little dehydrated, you're fine. Now, that's, of course, if you're not an elder or an infant, because the older you are or the younger you are, the harder it is for you to deal with the body stress related to a bout of diarrheal and vomiting illness. Nevertheless, we're talking about just in terms of lost wages, lost productivity, and medical costs, $152 billion. So maybe we should tighten up the food regulation, because you know what? Things have gotten really, really slack in the last few years with the FDA. Another related story we had this week, big news, not so important actually, was a story about a lawsuit that is a class action suit against 10 fish oil supplements. Actually, it's manufacturers and also the stores. Two large chain pharmacies, CVS and Rite Aid, are also named in the lawsuit. That's so that they can get more money. That's not really anything more than a very cynical legal maneuver. So I just want to talk to you about this. Fish oil supplements, this is the omega-3 fatty acids. You know I am a great, great advocate for the use of this particular food supplement. And one of my reasons for that is that in the manufacture of fish oils, the mercury gets filtered out. So eating the deep ocean wild fish does subject you to fairly significant risk for mercury. Eating farmed fish is where you get your PCBs. And PCBs are also present in the food chain out there in the oceans, but in very, very small amounts. Now, the PCB stands for polychlorinated biphenyls, and these are cancer-causing agents. We've tried to remove them from the food supply, but unfortunately, they're in the food chain and they can't be eliminated completely. But what we can do is limit our exposure and keep our exposure low. So the idea that certain products have higher levels of contamination certainly should make us take notice. But this is a sort of sensationalistic approach, and I think it's money grubbing rather than an actual fundamental desire to improve the status of health of the population. So I see this as a pretty cynical move. However, I do think that we have a right to expect that our supplements and our food sources are checked for known environmental contaminants such as PCB and mercury. And I, for one, would like to see that done in a more centralized way. And maybe the FDA is not up to it. Maybe we need the underwriter's laboratory, or we need to all choose and support a centralized non-governmental agency that would be charged with doing this inspecting. In fact, that might be a better idea, since it would be less likely to be subject to political influence, which has been a problem for the last few decades, probably longer, but I know about the last few decades intimately with the FDA. It's just very, very difficult for the FDA to avoid the political influence of whatever administration they're under. And so, not too surprisingly, now that we have a Democratic administration, we have the FDA clamping down on misleading health claims from various foods. And it's very nice that they're clamping down on fraudulent or semi-fraudulent labels. I mean, some of this stuff is really ridiculous. I love this one. This is a product from Dreyer's Ice Cream. It's called Dibs. I guess it's a bite-sized ice cream snack. Well, one of these things contains 17 grams of saturated fat, which is, by the way, very close to the daily maximum for saturated fat, which is 20 grams. Something is wrong with this picture when a product like that is putting a whoopee, no trans fat, healthy snack sign on their label and getting away with it. Sorry, Dreyer's, but realistically, this is a decadent treat food. It is not a health food. To close out the show, Jim in Big Sur says, Trader Joe's brand and Life Extension claim to have removed chemicals from their fish oils. Folks, we're going to come back next week with more on fish oils and contaminants and try to clarify this and get you some actual brands that you can trust. I'll work on that. That'll be my project for the week. Until then, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.